This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Oh, wow. I'm going to have a great day today. I always love when I have somebody in the studio with me, and today I have a very special guest. Her name is Wendy Levine, and she has written a book called Butterflies Are Free. What About Me? One Woman's Battle with Anorexia Nervosa. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Patsy.
Okay, well, I'm so glad that you're here in the studio with me, and we're going to talk about your fascinating book. It's one of these books that I love to bring to my listeners because it is a book that can help you if you have an eating disorder or anyone in your life who has an eating disorder. And in many cases, you might not recognize it. And Wendy is here and she will describe some of the symptoms so that if you think that somebody might have a problem, you're there to help them. And the wonderful thing about Wendy's book, it is not just a story of her life and her struggles, but she also has just filled it with so many resources. And this is one of the things that people look for when they are they're struggling with something. They need resources where they can go for help. And Wendy, I think you've done a beautiful job with this book.
Thank you very much.
Okay, well, it's going to be great to talk to you. I just have to go over a few things before, because I'm going to play an interview that I had yesterday with Brad Meltzer, because his book comes out today, but he didn't have any time today to talk, so I taped it yesterday. I'm going to play it in a few minutes. But before I do that, I want to remind every single one of you out there, if you have a book that you have written and it's not published, Writer's Digest has their big annual contest. It's the 88th annual Writer's Digest contest for unpublished, unproduced plays and unproduced works of art that you've if you've written a play or a screenplay or a book, you must enter this contest. And it is the deadline is May 6th. And there are going to be 500 winners this year. The grand prize, of course, is $5,000, but there are lots of smaller prizes. But that's not the big prize. The big prize is that you are having your book or novel, if it's a novel or a screenplay or a play, read by someone who really knows what they're doing. One of my guests a year ago was Nancy Peacock. Nancy Peacock self-published a book, and she then entered Writer's Digest contest for books that were already published. And she got an amazing, amazing contract for them to republish this book. In this case, this contest is for the unpublished. So if you have that book sitting there and you think it's pretty good, well, get working on it. You've got almost 5 months to get it in order, make it as perfect as possible. Sit down with your writing group, hire an editor, and polish it, and then submit it. It's just a wonderful opportunity because Writer's Digest is really the premier contest for writers because all of the readers are either New York City literary agents, New York City editors, New York City people in the publishing business. So these are really people who know a good book when they see it. So please consider entering this contest. And thinking about advances and everything, I wanted to say that this week my favorite person is Marcy Posner, who is an agent for Folio Literary, and she has gotten a six-figure deal for Christy Clancy for her debut book. A six-figure deal. Isn't that wonderful for somebody who it's her first book, and she's already got six figures in advance. Oh, and it's so nice because, you know, with advances, you actually get to keep it. You never pay it back. But the truth is, you probably spend it too fast. Hopefully, you invest it wisely, because it might be your only six-figure advance. You never know. But I want to tell you all that this news was in Publishers Weekly. And as I say to all of you, if you are looking for an agent, you want an agent who is active. And if you can find an agent who just got somebody a six-figure deal, that's somebody you want to investigate and see if you can submit your query letter. And you never know. My goodness, isn't it, Wendy, isn't it wonderful to get a six-figure advance for your first book?
I can try.
You can try. Well, I think, Wendy, after this, of course, book that she's written, it's a nonfiction book, and it's a very moving book. But I've already talked to Wendy, and I'm telling her I think she's a fine writer, a really fine writer. And she can write some more books and come out with maybe a mystery, and we'll see. And you never know what happens. This is a wonderful thing about the world of being an author. So, how do you feel now that you finished your first book?
I feel relieved. It took many years to complete this book because I wasn't sure that I really wanted to put myself out there. I wanted to help people because that's what I feel most comfortable doing. But by exposing myself, I said with tongue in cheek, there are no more skeletons in my closet. It's okay now. I've made peace with that. You know, if someone should say, well, she's too crazy, I'm not going to deal with her because of everything that they, you know about me, it's their problem, not mine. And I've already gotten positive responses. Some people who I hadn't heard from in years came forth to tell me that reading my book helped them in certain ways, and some people who only knew me and didn't know about my struggles now told me that they're so educated.
And that's the whole point of this book, to really help people, to educate them, because there are so many things. You know, it's not, it's been a subject of some Lifetime movies, and of course we all know about the most famous person, Karen Carpenter, who it was, I love her music so much, and it's so heartbreaking every time, and I think, you know, wow, if she had perhaps had the help she needed, she'd be singing today. And, you know, when I see some of the singers who are, you know, they're in their 60s and they're doing rock tours and they're out there and having fun still. As a matter of fact, I think many of the rock stars, and I've talked to some, I've had some on who have written books here, and they're enjoying their tours more today, because when they were young, they were sort of out of it. A lot of them were drinking in those days, but now they're not drinking and they're not on drugs, and so they can actually appreciate their music and they're proud of themselves. And certainly Karen Carpenter was so brilliant.
She was one of my favorites, and I sensed that there was something wrong with her. I really did. They say, you know, that if you are unfortunate enough to have one of the eating disorders, you can kind of sniff out someone else with an eating disorder. And I have to say that when she was ill, not a lot was known about eating disorders. Just like when I became ill, it took years for them to find out what was wrong. I mean, it took...
Oh, back in the 60s and 70s, nobody knew anything about it. I don't think most people even had heard about it until perhaps when she passed away, but there wasn't a lot of discussion. And it's only in the past few years they've had movies on Lifetime, and I don't know if there's any big films, but I know quite a few shows on Lifetime. But other than that, it wasn't discussed. And so what you're doing is really important. So when I get back to you, I want you, you mentioned different type of eating disorder. So you'll give us a little education on that. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go ahead now and play my interview with Brad Meltzer from yesterday. He is so wonderful. And after the interview, I spoke to him, and we are arranging that we're going to actually have a Brad Meltzer hour, and he's going to come on for the entire hour and give us a little mini course in how to really write a fantastic chapter, because I love him. I know his work so well, and so I'm going to play this, and then I'm going to come back and just enjoy this interview with Brad. It is a joy for me to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Brad Meltzer, to talk about his latest and certainly one of his greatest books ever, The First Conspiracy, The Secret Plot to Kill George Washington. Hi, Brad.
Hey, Patsy. Good to hear your voice again.
Oh, wow. I don't know what to say. This is so fantastic. This book, I'm reading it, and when I got to the end, I said, what did I just read? It's like I saw an entire movie in my head. It is fantastic.
Oh, thank you so much. I found this story, and I was just as surprised as you are nearly a decade ago. And I was going through the place where all good stories are found in the footnotes, and I found this, that there was a secret plot to kill George Washington. I'm like, what? What is that? Is it true? Is this internet nonsense? What is it? And it was true. In 1776, at the beginning of the Revolutionary War, there was a plot to kill George Washington. And when George Washington found out about it, he put in motion a secret committee called the Committee on Conspiracies to figure it out. And what you see in the book is how he figures out the plot, what he does, who's responsible. This Committee on Conspiracies, which is one of the great titles of a secret committee I've ever heard, is just changes history. And to this day, the committee was led by John Jay. There is a room in CIA headquarters today in Langley, Virginia, that honors John Jay, who they call the father of counterintelligence, tracing back to this moment when he helped uncover the plot to kill George Washington.
You are, to me, the quintessential chapter writer. I get so excited with your writing because you have this wonderful way to do the slow reveal. And as I was reading The First Conspiracy, and I get to chapter 5, and it starts off, the sky above Manhattan is overcast. And then you explain about George Washington calling people together, and then what's going to happen. This is a mystery for us right from the beginning. We have to read this book. We have to know what's happening.
Yeah, and what happens is when, you know, my first thought was, is it even real? And it was real. It really did happen. When George Washington found out about the plot to kill him, he launched a secret committee called the Committee on Conspiracies. And it was this great Committee on Conspiracies led by John Jay, who eventually became the first Supreme Court Justice, that ferrets out the information, interrogates people, kicks down doors. They're the ones who figure out what really happened. And as you read the book, you'll slowly see who's responsible, how the mystery is unfurled. And to this day, there is, in CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, there is a room dedicated to John Jay, who they call the father of counterintelligence. And it dates back all to this secret plot to kill George Washington.
I love this book. As you know, you were on my third anniversary program because I love your writing so much. And over the years, people have always asked me, you know, how can I improve my writing? And my answer to them ever since last year has been, okay, there are a couple of things that you have to do. You have to read Chapter 7 of The Escape Artist by Brad Meltzer, because I think Chapter 7 is one of the best, the most beautifully written chapters, two-page chapter, where you just grab the heart and the emotion of readers. And then I add, then if you want the best, very best first sentence, you have to read The Tenth Justice, because that opens up with such a perfect line, Ben Addison was sweating like a pig. So now I'm going to add, when I make my recommendations, that everyone has to go to Chapter 5 in your new book, and you then start us on this wonderful, glorious path of reading this book.
No, I appreciate it. And listen, that's the thriller writer in me, of course, is helpful to tell this story, but this is a story that doesn't need me to create any cliffhangers because the cliffhangers are there. This is a real nonfiction story. And as I was, as Josh mentioned, I were doing the research on it. We were going, here's the cliffhanger. Here's the moment where, you know, one of my favorite moments in the book is finding out that George Washington had his own private bodyguard. I didn't know anything about this. It was at the beginning of the war, George Washington asked all of his regiments for the four top men. He wanted the best of the best. And he narrowed it down to about 50 men. They called them the General's Guards, the Commander's Guards. But the name they eventually became known by was the Lifeguard, because their job was truly to guard George Washington's life. And it was these lifeguards, and again, I won't ruin it, but let's just say that maybe some of these lifeguards aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing. And when they turn on him, I don't care how strong you are, what a great general you are, anything else, it is devastating when George Washington finds out about that.
Well, there are so many perfect, wonderful lines in this book. And, of course, one of them is you can't trust anyone. that was great. What I also love were exactly all these details of things that we didn't know about or we didn't quite see. And I loved when you have you describe when George Washington came to New York City on the same day that the mayor of New York City arrived. This description, I had never read about this before. And what I loved, it was so thrilling for me when you know, I've always been interested in Alexander Hamilton, and, you know, everybody's Hamilton now. But I never pictured him sort of in my mind as a 19-year-old student. And I thought, that is so great what you found there.
Well, isn't that one of my favorite moments? Of course, you picked up on one of my favorite moments, too, because I was blown away by it, is I love that moment where you find out that Alexander Hamilton, there's this great moment where George Washington is coming to New York for the first time as the leader of the troops. One of the people who's working against him, the governor of New York at the time, is also coming into town at the same exact day. And in the middle of these parades, these two men, unstoppable force and immovable object, are coming into New York on the same day. In the crowd cheering is a young man named Alexander Hamilton. And I love that we all know what the ending of the story is. But here's where you see the beginning. And that's how it is for George Washington throughout. My favorite story, I think, in the book is this moment in the Battle of Brooklyn, one of the great first battles in New York. And, you know, we love to think, oh, we were the ragtag group and we banded together and we beat the bad guys. But we were getting our butts kicked. George Washington got out-generaled. He wasn't as advanced and as knowledgeable as all the British generals were. He didn't have the experience. And it's a moment where George Washington is pinned down. We should arguably die right there. But George Washington in that moment could easily beat his chest and say, I'm going to take out as many of them as I can, go out in a blaze of glory. But instead, George Washington does the greatest thing he always does, which is he adapts. And one of the things he does in that moment is he commandeers all the boats on the East River, and he slowly, one by one, makes all of his men get into these boats to sail in a daring escape and make sure that they don't die. But what his men see is that George Washington won't get in the boat himself until every one of his men is on board. He's risking his life to save theirs. And that's one of those moments where we first come together as a country. There was no United States back then. George Washington had to help build it by putting his arms around all of us and saying that we need to stand together. And I love that you not just see the secret plot to kill George Washington in this nonfiction book, but you get to also see George Washington's character develop.
Oh, and there are really so many wonderful things, but I think that just seeing Alexander Hamilton as an undergraduate student at, well, King's College, or now Columbia, it was like, whoa, it was a revelation. And I thought, well, that's Brad Meltzer for you. You're going to get all of these little things just put in there gradually, you know, layer by layer. You just enrich everything that you write all the time. I always love your research. I always love everything that you know, the way that you slip history in there. And it's funny, I know this is a nonfiction book, but I mean, I didn't read it as a nonfiction book. I read it as a thriller. That's why I don't want you to give things away. I don't think you should, like, blurt out what's going to happen, because I didn't know what was going to happen. And when I got really excited...
Yeah, no, of course, and that's the fun of it. The fun of it is you kind of eventually know what happened, but you don't, you have this, I mean, again, I won't ruin any of it, but when you see what happens with these counterfeiters, when you see what happens with the prostitutes, when you see what happens with the people in his house, when you see all the people that are making moves behind his back, you can't help but go, oh my God, history could have easily gone the other way. And when you see how he figures it out, it is a thriller.
It is.
It's nonfiction, but it really does read like one.
It is a thriller, and that's why it's just so fantastic. And I think one of the most wonderful things is we didn't know that perhaps one of the most important people to America was Lawrence Washington. We had no idea.
Yeah, let's talk about him a moment. Lawrence Washington is George Washington's half-brother. And we owe him for many reasons. One, because he's the one, as a military man, who inspired his younger brother, George. That's why George Washington was so determined to enter the military. He didn't have this father. He didn't have anything, but he had this brother, Lawrence. And the opening scene of the book is this moment where his brother is dying, and he dies. He loses his brother. George Washington has nothing now. And to me, we all know George Washington. We see him on the dollar bill every day. But oddly, we know the least about him as a person. And I really wanted to show what he was made of. And you see, I won't ruin the scene, but what happens with smallpox in the book because of his brother is one of the most amazing reveals in the whole book.
Oh.
And it's all because George Washington had this incredible brother.
Well, you know, as I said, you were on my third anniversary program, and I'm coming up to my fourth anniversary. And I want to thank you, Brad, so much for just being such a fantastic author and for being a guest on Joy on Paper. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. You honor me with both. I really appreciate it. And thanks for always cheering for us, whether it's with the thrillers, with the I Am books, or with this nonfiction book. I really appreciate it.
Oh, and the kids' books, the one you released on September 11th last year, the girl.
Yeah, I Am Neil Armstrong.
Oh, yeah. Oh, fantastic. You're just amazing. And I have to say bye now, but I hope that you'll come back on and maybe spend an hour with me. One day we'll talk about writing, and you can actually do a course right here on Joy on Paper, okay?
Anytime.
Okay. Bye, my Brad. Bye.
Okay, well, I had so much fun talking to him yesterday and then talking to him again in the evening about him teaching a course right here on Joy on Paper. This is going to be really exciting. I'm not going to have a commercial when he comes on. We're going to do the whole hour, and we'll go and just with the samples of his wonderful, wonderful books and his writing. And, you know, when you meet somebody like Brad, and the excitement that he has is really that joy on paper that I'm always talking about. So I will let everyone know when that's going to happen, because it's going to be a real university-style one-hour course on how to make your novel exciting. Now, I'm going to take a quick commercial break. And when I come back, Wendy's going to explain to us more about anorexia and about her struggles and about her success. And so we'll be right back.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead, and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my guest in the studio, Wendy Levine, who has written a book called Butterflies Are Free, What About Me? One Woman's Battle with Anorexia Nervosa. Well, Wendy, it's really so great to have you here in the studio. Tell me, when you have this disease, or is it sort of like when you say you're an alcoholic, you're never recovered? It's always there, something that you have to deal with.
I believe so. There would be some therapists who would disagree, but I believe that in times of stress, personally I can attest to it, that in times of great stress, eating disorder behaviors do unfortunately rear their ugly head. And I do know of therapists who say that it's like something sitting on your shoulder. It's always
forever
there.
So
there are two camps, and I'm in the camp that you're always in recovery.
Okay, well, it's so good that you have really, now it's taken you a lot of years to get to a point where you are free now to write this book, to talk about it, to get out there and to help other people, and hopefully to help a lot of younger women before they spend a lifetime like you have of struggle. And nobody really understands the cost of it, not just the cost in time, the time you spend thinking about food, the cost of time of actually deciding what to eat. So I want you to explain that. And then the cost of medical treatment. And you have spent a lot of money over the years.
Yes, I have.
And in treatment, and you've been hospitalized a number of times?
A number of times. I really couldn't tell you how many times. I mean, it's been at least five.
Okay, so let's go back. When did this start for you, and what was the diagnosis? How did it happen?
It all started when I was 16 and a half. And, you know, just a disclaimer is it's not anyone's fault. It's they do now, there's been research, and they know that there is a genetic component, something to do with one of the chromosomes. And in my family, there are other people who have eating disorders. And my family was moving from Massachusetts to New York State. I was 16 and a half. You're going through all different changes and everything. And I was a little bit overweight, and I had really short hair. And I said, I'm going to create a new me. I'm going to grow my hair, and I'm going to lose weight. And then it just kind of went on. I lost weight, and people told me I looked great. I looked like Twiggy. And it just kept going on all through college. And I was a normal weight, but I was on the thin side. And then I really began restricting and became very thin. And it wasn't until I was in my late 20s, early 30s that I was officially diagnosed. Because earlier than that, people just thought, well, she's just crazy. they really didn't have a name for it.
Yes, I remember those days that nobody knew anything about it. When I look back now, I think there probably I knew girls who were having problems, because although you were thin, when you were in college, you thought you were fat.
Right.
I mean, you really believed it in your head. I mean, this is a hard concept for people to understand. She's beautifully thin, looking so good, but she thinks she's fat, and it's hard to get this.
People don't understand it. Even today, I feel I'm in recovery. I'm not going to lie and say that I'm fully recovered. I mean, I have a dear friend who told me I couldn't write the book until I was fully recovered. And I said, that will be maybe never.
Never. So I said, get on with it. Let's get this out here.
I'm going to do it, but I'm not going to claim that I'm fully recovered. Every day I struggle with food. There are certain foods I don't eat. I, you know, will skip a meal here and there. I have, you know, trouble. And I do a lot of self-talk. And that you really have to be vigilant. And the self-talk helps a lot in this illness.
Now, when the first time you were hospitalized, what were you hospitalized for? What did they say you had?
That was for anorexia nervosa.
So you were, by this point, you were so sick, so thin, because you basically are taking in no nutrients.
Right. And I was in the hospital, and it's been true most of the time when I've been in the hospital in an eating disorders unit that I've been the oldest person there. But more and more, eating disorders are becoming prevalent in middle age and even the elderly. And I don't want to discount the fact that men also suffer from eating disorders. It's not just a woman's only disorder.
I think I was vaguely aware of it, but until I read your book, I didn't understand that this is also a problem for men. So how do they treat you? What did they do that first time?
The first time it was, I'm calling it very primitive compared to what it was 7 years ago when I was hospitalized in Florida. It was an eating disorders unit. We had the A patients who were anorexics, and we had the B patients who were bulimics.
And explain that for people who don't understand the difference. What's the difference between anorexic and bulimic?
An anorexic person believes that they're fat and restricts their calories and oftentimes will exercise to get rid of calories. And a bulimic person does not, sometimes they exercise, but they binge and sometimes they purge and sometimes they don't purge. There's, you know, different methods.
Okay, so you were in the A section, and
yes.
What did they do? What's the treatment? I mean, do they give you Big Macs or something?
No, we had balanced, what they called balanced diets. We had no say. This is what's so crazy. Here we are in an eating disorders unit. We had a nutritionist, and we had no say in our menu choices. We had to eat what we were given. I guess maybe we had one food choice.
So like prison.
It was like prison when I think about it. And it was kind of funny because there was a monitor, two monitors walking around the room during mealtime.
Just like prison. That's what they do in prison.
Making sure that you were consuming your meal, because very often the anorexic patients would like slip some food to the bulimic patients who wanted the food, and the anorexic patients didn't want the food.
And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to laugh, but I was just thinking, because I have this image now of Wendy writing mystery stories. Wendy, you have a lot of material here.
I will have to think about
it. You have to find some humor in this too to survive it, because it was the dark time for you.
It was very dark because I didn't really know what was going on. I also suffer from depression. I suffered then, and
you would because you have
nothing coming in, and your brain is in a fog,
and without nutrients, which really help with the whole brain chemistry.
You need,
and as they've discovered now, and this is something I'm very strongly opposed to, people restricting their children, the babies, from regular food, because there is this growing sort of movement where they are taking, I'm talking babies.
I understand.
And they're not giving them enough regular food, and like restricting milk, but the brain needs some fat.
Yes.
It needs fats. It can't survive if you're just going to drink water. And I mean, we're built to ingest and, you know, digest this food to make us stronger.
At my worst, I ate 500 calories a day. And I was in my 20s then. I couldn't do that today, I know, because I'm older. But I worked in downtown Boston.
And you actually knew how many calories you ate?
Oh, yes.
Well, you know, that is starvation. In China, when they had the great famine in the 60s, that's what they were eating, 500 calories.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, at that point when you said, I'm having 500 calories, and what's the normal calories you should have, around 1,100, 1,200? I think normally people
I think normally people eat 1,600.
Yeah, if, you know, guys eat more if they're very mm-hmm. active, and women too. But so you knew it was too little, but there was nothing you could do yourself to.
There was nothing I could do. And
but these monitors, like when you were in this place, the first place, they're watching you to make sure, and they're probably trying to feed you like 1,200 calories or something.
I had no idea at that time what they were doing, except that I didn't agree with their methodology. If you didn't finish all of your meal, you had to drink a Carnation instant meal supplement.
Oh gosh, I'm telling you, this is like a prison hospital.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. It was primitive.
Yeah.
We're talking over 30 years ago.
Okay, but since then, of course. But in between, you had more hospitalizations.
I had more hospitalizations.
And did the hospitals improve?
It was the same thing, but then I also had hospitalizations for the depression part.
Yeah.
And, then I got to choose what I would eat or wouldn't eat. But I do have to say that a local, am I allowed to say the name of
yeah,
the
Yeah, sure.
Fairwinds in Clearwater really helped me improve my life. It wasn't primitive. The nutritionist sat down with you. Every week we got to choose from menus. We got to make our meal plans. We, if we didn't finish a meal, we didn't have to drink a whole can of Boost or anything. We drank the equal amount of calories that we missed. And that's how we supplemented.
Huh. Okay, so, but what, then what changed, what tactic worked for you that you started to realize, I mean, was there something that they did, or was it something that you did that just sort of put you on the right path, that you started eating normally, what we call normally?
What they did. It's, I was always afraid, because in my whole life, when I think about it, I never really ate normally, because I became ill at 16 and a half. And, you
so
know,
30 years you're going on like that?
I've been ill. I count, you know, my age today. I've been dealing with anorexia for 47 years. And
you don't even look 47, actually. She looks very young.
I'm way older
than
that.
She's very pretty. And she's thin and beautiful. That's all I can say. She's got a great shape, and you know, it's just
thank you.
It's just wonderful that you're out there now trying to help, so other people don't go through 47 years of it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. It's hard, really, for people to conceive of
it's
that. And of course, it's affected your work, because one of the things I like about your book, you've given a lot of resources and a lot of information for people, because if they have this problem and they're in a job, sometimes you do have to take time off for hospitalizations. And what did you find with your life and your career?
I found that it really impeded my career, because I was... at my lowest weight, not to trigger anyone who might be listening, but I was 92 pounds. And I can now say that I looked too thin. Then I didn't think I looked thin. And I had to go in the hospital. And, you know, when you're gone for a month, an employer doesn't really like that. Nowadays, I suppose a person could, you know, say, well, you know, legally you can't get rid of me. They never fired me, but I never got promotions. I was 5 years here, 5 years there, and I always got great reviews. And
but there was always this fear.
There was always this fear of, well, is she going to relapse? Is she, you know, and
And you can't blame them.
I can't blame them in a way, but I just know that if the eating disorder hadn't been in my life, I could have done a lot more. And even my writing, I could have, God only knows, because I was the recipient of a scholarship from Rotary International that would have given me the money to travel abroad in my graduate work and be an ambassador for the Rotary organization, which was going to sponsor me, and they were going to give me spending money, and I could stay in Europe for a few months after my studies. And I wasn't diagnosed then, but I knew something was wrong. And as soon as I got this scholarship, I ran to the library to see what kind of food they ate in Wales. It's like, what am I doing? Yeah. I got this scholarship. I didn't tell anyone, but I went to the library, and then I told people, and I, you know, had a sick feeling because I said, how am I going to go? And in the end, I was honest, but I didn't realize I was being honest. I had to tell the Rotary in New Paltz, New York, that there was illness in my family. I couldn't take advantage of the scholarship. And looking back, I really was ill, and I didn't know it.
So you were afraid to travel to another country because you were having enough problems here.
Mm-hmm.
So you did you ever travel to other countries?
Yes, I have.
And what do you do? I
can tell you, on my honeymoon to Hawaii, which is not another country, I packed cans of tuna fish.
You took tuna to Hawaii.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah.
But I did that. And otherwise, I've only been to the Netherlands. And
and that's a hard place to go and not eat their food.
And not eat their food. But I did just, you know, eat, you know, I could eat, the limited things that I could eat.
That you thought you could eat.
That I thought I could eat.
What you limited yourself to.
Right.
Because of this problem. Well, And as you said, now the new place that you went to, they had a different approach.
A different approach.
Was one of them that they really made you get in touch with what you were doing?
Yes, we had therapy. We had art therapy. Art therapy for someone like me who is more verbal with the written word. I can't draw a straight line to save my life, but the art therapy was useful. And, you know, the one-on-one therapy, the group therapy, some of the other patients told me that, you know, I gave them hope because they saw me at my age still in there fighting to survive. And I took one patient under my wing. She was 18, and I thought she was 16 then because she was in high school. And I thought she was going to not make it. And I'm happy to say she's now graduating from nursing school. And, you know, people do make it. Some people flourish. Other people, I have some friends who are still struggling. It breaks my heart. And I'm here to help anyone in any way I can. And the one thing that I want to stress to people, the earlier an eating disorder is diagnosed, the greater the chances are for a full recovery. I mean, people say that they do recover, and I think those are the people who fully recover, are the ones who are diagnosed
quickly and dealt with before it becomes
ingrained as a habit.
An obsession that you can't stop yourself.
Right.
You know, like taking tuna to Hawaii or counting every calorie. I mean, do you still weigh yourself every day?
Unfortunately, yes.
But is one of the goals that you don't do it?
Yes, that's hopefully a goal that I am working on.
So you don't think, like, if you just go out and buy yourself a nice wardrobe at your perfect weight, which is right now, because you look just perfect, and then throw away the scale and just say, if it gets tight, then that's a... you know, that's when I have to start restricting myself. You
know, right now I'm not there.
You're not there.
Maybe one day I will be there.
You will, and that might be a way to do it. You know,
might be.
Yeah, you get yourself an expensive wardrobe.
I don't know about that.
No, really.
That's when I get my six-figure advance.
That's right. She's going to write a bunch of mystery stories with an anorexic detective, and then we'll have I'll be able to announce that she gets a six-figure advance. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yes.
That's a goal. You know, because you've gone through so many years of struggle that you deserve now to have a wonderful and happy life.
Thank you. I will be happy if my story really helps others.
Well, I think it will. And one of the things, as I said, in the back of the book, you have details there. Can you explain just a little bit about the insurance and what are some of the things that anorexics should know?
Insurance companies do not want to pay. It's a anorexia and bulimia and binge eating disorder, something that we didn't even talk about, that I didn't know about until I was in Fairwinds, are psychiatric illnesses, and insurance companies don't like to pay for these illnesses. And it's very hard to get them to
because now, like, Fairwinds was a... You're there. I mean, you're there. It's an inpatient, you don't leave.
You're there for a minimum of 28 days. And then insurance, it feels like it's on a day-by-day basis. Is insurance going to kick me out today? And then they have a step-down program, which is IOP program, that you come back for meals at night and...
And a little more therapy, encouragement and helping you to work through your problems.
To wean you off. I mean, you don't go home and you're just home and, oh my God, like after being hospitalized. And
I don't have anyone to talk to or anything. So that makes it a really important and wonderful place that they have the ongoing structure to help you maintain what you've learned.
But insurance companies make it very rough. I've heard of stories where young people have died waiting to get the okay from insurance companies to go into treatment.
Well, you would think that they would be a little better at it nowadays. I mean, they do have insurance covers for people who have drug problems, and they go in and they're covered for that. And you know, this is a disease that can just take away your life, and it's sad.
It is. Eating disorders, and anorexia in particular, has one of the highest mortality rates of psychiatric illnesses.
Do they know how many people in the United States, how many people have anorexia?
According to the National Eating Disorder Association, 20 million women and 10 million men will suffer from an eating disorder at some point in their life.
Wow.
That is, like, when you think about that, it is mind-boggling.
It is. Now, is anorexia also something that it's in other countries? I mean, we're not the only country. I mean, it's a worldwide problem.
It's a worldwide. It divides. It's other countries. Doesn't matter. It's race, it crosses race, it crosses economic class, age. Children as young as 8 have been known to be restricting. Because I've done research, I'm giving a talk next month, and it's just very scary. But at least what makes me feel good nowadays is to know that people will not... you know, hopefully slip through the cracks. There was no knowledge for someone to help me. You know, they said, okay, she's depressed, but
And it restricted your actions with people. I mean, it must have been difficult. Oh. People would worry about inviting you to events and if they knew about your problem or...
Mm-hmm. Yeah? I'm a people person. I have a really wonderful network of friends, and I love them, and it makes me sad that, you know, I went through 3.5 years because I accelerated my classes so I could get out early, but going through 3.5 years of college and not even having a single friend because the eating disorder took my whole life.
And partly just the time that you spent thinking about it.
Thinking
about
it.
Because most people don't think about what they, I mean, it's not a big sort of, it's not time consuming or, you know, but you actually counted calories, counted, I don't know if you could count, I think I saw one Lifetime movie where the girl was counting peas. She was eating like one pea at a time.
No, I never did quite that far, but, you know, my friends now are my friends. They know, and they're not going to, you know, not invite me to something. I just won't eat the pizza if that's it. Or maybe
or
it's
you
a
might
day.
Eat the pizza.
Or I might eat it. I might eat a slice to make everyone happy.
No, yeah, you have. See, we're going to say, eat a slice because you're beautiful. You're beautiful.
You are so sweet.
And I think that's so important that you recognize that.
And anyone deserves to eat pizza.
Exactly.
Everyone deserves to have everything in moderation.
Exactly.
I know that. Intellectually, I know that.
Well, I think that you've done a wonderful job with this book. You're a fine writer.
Thank you.
You have it in there, a diary, and the diary just reads so beautifully, and the writing is so fine. And I think that you have a great future as a writer now that you have time to think about writing, which is something there. That's something mm-hmm. you want to get obsessed about because, you know, as I said when I was talking to Brad Meltzer, it is such a joy when you know that you're helping people with your writing.
Mm-hmm.
And in Brad's case, this was his first, you know, nonfiction book. He wanted to write this book to tell people about how absolutely, really wonderful, the first conspiracy, the plot to kill George Washington, how very important George Washington was to the United States, how everything would have changed without him because he was the strength. He was what people needed at the time. People needed to have somebody strong like that. And now you have a book, and you can go out there, and it's wonderful that you're going to be. I predict you'll be making lots of speeches, invited to lots of events, so that you can help people and make them feel better with your writing. I'm really impressed with you, Wendy.
Well, I'm honored that you invited me to be on your show. And that you believe in my future in writing, because that's what I love to do most.
I can see that. You get a smile on your face the minute you talk about it. Now, how can people contact you? The book is available where? On Amazon?
On Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com.
And then do you have a Facebook? What's your social media? What do you do?
Butterflies Are Free on Facebook.
Facebook
Butterflies Are Free. And then if they wanted to contact me at...
they can send a message on Butterflies Are
Butterflies
Free.
Are
That's
free.
The best way. Do it, and you can contact Wendy. And if you want a speaker for an event, invite Wendy, and she'll be there, and she will help you and help you recognize the problems and the signs of anorexia so you can help people that you know. And meanwhile, I want to just say to everyone, remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very lucky, to one day hear those words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be made into a film or a streaming video, or maybe, like I hope for Carol J. Perry, that her books will be turned into a special series on Hallmark Channel. And she's going to be coming in February to talk about her newest book. She's always so delightful. And of course, say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed. He's saluting me. I'm saluting him. Bye-bye. Have a great day.